Some curiousness set off into the darkness to ask Yeshua, "Who are you?" I found him on a rooftop overlooking the city, and I suddenly realized I do not know how to address him. So many people have been calling him a lunatic, a heretic, a traitor. I settle on Rabbi. "We know you're a teacher from God," I say. "The things you do, miracles, there's no other explanation." The look in Yeshua's eyes stopped me short. "I'm one of the most wise and intelligent people in all of Jerusalem. I'm a teacher of others, and I have not been made feel like I have something left to learn for in a very long time." "Nicodemus," says Yeshua, "if you hope to learn what God is really up to, you'll need to be born again. How do you expect me to become newborn?" "You are the teacher, but you don't understand." "Not really, no." And then Yeshua really confuses me. "Like Moses lifted up the stake in the desert," says Yeshua, "I'm going to be lifted up. Whoever puts their trust in me will be saved." Saved? What? Yeshua is referencing a story from thousands of years ago. Moses was leading God's people from Egypt to the land that was promised them. And as they crossed the vast desert, people were bitten by snakes and many were dying. So God told Moses to fashion a bronze snake on a long pole, and they lifted it up among all the people, and anyone who looked at it would be saved. I know this is kind of a strange story, yet I can't quite piece together what Yeshua is trying to say through it. And before I know, the conversation is over. I had come with just one question: who are you? But as I hurry home, my questions are growing exponentially. But this much, I think I've been able to piece together. I called Yeshua a rabbi, a teacher. But Yeshua is not claiming to be a teacher. He is claiming to be the Savior. And I wonder, what if I believe him? With each passing month, the crowds around Yeshua grew, and the people seemed divided between those who adored him and those who wished they could ignore him. But in the Sanhedrin, there is little disagreement. These men make up the highest court, the respectable rulers. They feel as though they must protect the people from being deluded by a madman. It doesn't hurt that by eliminating Yeshua, they are also protecting their own power. Yeshua must be silenced by whatever means necessary, and on this, they are united. Except I have this feeling. I haven't been able to shake since that night on the rooftop. The conversation had hardly made sense to me, and yet I know there is something more to this man, Yeshua. I've been careful to keep these thoughts quiet.
Once we got to the garden, it just got crazy. Yeshua asked James, John, and I to go further in the garden with him and pray. Well, we tried to, but we kept falling asleep. Yeshua kept waking us up saying, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He got that right. So Judas betrayed Yeshua with the kiss of a friend. They come to arrest him, so I attack. There is no way they are going to take him. I pull my sword and strike at one of the closest to me, aiming high, but he ducks. So I slash the side of his head, cutting off his ear. And we expect that to be the spark that begins the battle to put Yeshua on the throne. All we needed was for the soldiers to retaliate, to fight back. We were ready to fight to the death if that was what it was going to take. We had it planned. We were prepared for it. It was the only way. Yeshua had said that he was going to be beaten and killed, but we all thought he was stirring us up to protect him with our lives. He also said that he would die and then after 3 days would rise again. But he may as well have been saying the water in the Jordan would flow into the sea and then turn around and flow back up again. We just couldn't comprehend what he was telling us. Instead of a mighty battle, Yeshua ends all of our plans with a shout. "It's me you want, let these others go." He put Malchus's ear back on his head and tells us to put our swords away. Then Yeshua, the Lord's anointed one, offers himself to his captors. And our hearts fail us, our terror overcome us, and we run. If we can't fight, then what would we be going to do? I couldn't just watch him take him and do nothing. But Yeshua stopped us doing anything. Oh, how confused I was.
My name is Joseph, and I come from the Judean town of Arimathea. I was there on the night that the rabbi Yeshua was arrested and brought to trial. I am a member of the Sanhedrin Council, and I heard the full account. The council was ready to rule on him whenever they caught the rabbi away from the crowds, and it surprised us all that we were called to meet before the festival. We understood that the council was trying to avoid the festival altogether, because that is when the crowds are largest.
The council was called in the early hours. Guards that were sent to arrest Yeshua returned with him bound and already beaten. During the trial, I hoped to hear Yeshua confess to the question, "Who are you?" And when he did confess, it caused an uproar and was declared blasphemy.
His sudden arrest caught us all off guard, and so the trial held in the early hours was rushed, and between you and me, it was an absolute joke. Since when did we meet in haste? And what about beating a suspect before a decision on them has been made? I was shocked and, I admit to you, I was terrified of what was to happen, both to Yeshua and to us. What was the charge against this man? Well, we could not settle on a charge, could we? The witnesses could not agree. The council finally based its actions that day on Yeshua's supposed blasphemy, although in reality the decision had been made long before. I say the council made the decision, but it was really made by Caiaphas and Annas, those two power-hungry manipulators. I wanted no part in the decision, but to speak up against them was dangerous, and to side with someone like Yeshua, that was pure suicide. You see, from what I had experienced, he was not like other rabbis. He made crippled men walk. He made blind men see. He made dead children breathe. He made lepers clean. He fed thousands of people on a hillside with only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Many of us were convinced that he was the long-awaited Messiah, the anointed one that the prophets spoke about. He had been teaching with authority in our temple for months, and crowds have followed his every word, and I would say that it was the last thing that was his downfall. Some in the Sanhedrin might say his crime started when he healed on the Sabbath, but nobody notices a nobody. It was the crowd that killed him. We saw it when he rode into the city on that donkey, and on that day of all days. If only he had walked in, or ridden a horse, or even the chariot, that would have worked. Anything but a donkey, the way Zechariah had prophesied that the king would enter the city. Hindsight is a beautiful thing. The donkey and the crowds declared him to be the anointed one, and that was his demise. My name is Joseph of Arimathea, and I dissented from the decision to condemn Yeshua. Following that ridiculous trial, it was out of our hands, and there was nothing we could do. Typically, there was a great deal of political maneuvering between Caiaphas and Pilate, and finally the Romans tortured him and murdered him.
I expected nothing but a routine day of work. From time to time, we were called upon to crucify a criminal or two, which really didn't bother us, since we were Roman soldiers and had been trained to kill. Executing people was all part of the job. That particular day, we weren't exactly sure how many people would be crucifying. The matter hadn't been settled until early morning. We already knew that a couple of troublemakers would be crucified, but we were unsure about a third man. A political game was being played between our chief of state, Pontius Pilate, who was a weakling that we didn't respect very much, and the chief priest of the Jews. Pilate really wanted to execute a political prisoner by the name of Barabbas. He'd been arrested for trying to stir up an insurrection and overthrow the Roman Empire, which was really quite humorous to us, as the thought of us made us laugh.
Makes no sense. There I was, caught stinking on myself. You know, stealing, murdering, you name it, I've done it. And I knew the next time I stepped out of that jail, well, it was over. I'm done. And the guards that came and got me, and they put me beside this guy that had been beaten to a pulp, smashed badly. Then Governor Pontius Pilate began asking the crowd, "Which one of these men do you want me to set free?" By surprise, the crowd started chanting, "Barabbas, Barabbas." And he said, "What about Yeshua? You loved him only a week ago." The crowd ignored him and they let me go. They took Yeshua away. 1 minute I'm a man marked for death, and the next I'm free. It made no sense.
but the chief priests wanted a man named Yeshua of Nazareth to be crucified. We'd heard about him, of course. Everybody had heard about him. And to be honest, at first, his popularity with the Jewish people concerned us. His ability to feed an army in the wilderness from limited resources and to heal his wounded would make him a formidable foe. Yet he proclaimed a love of your enemies and a trust in his God. The day began just like any other day. As I walked through the streets of Jerusalem, I sensed that emotions were running a little higher than normal. Jerusalem was crowded. Thousands of Jews had arrived for the observance of their Passover, which was one of their religious holidays. I wasn't a religious man. In fact, I believed religion was just something for weak people, like the Jews. But everyone on the streets that morning had an opinion about Yeshua. Some were quite fond of him. Many spoke of his kindness towards them. Some of them even claimed that he had healed them. Others had become convinced that he was a prophet of God. On the other hand, many people, especially the Jewish religious leaders, were infuriated by his radical religious teaching. I didn't pay much attention to them because all of this was just a good example of the kind of religious nonsense the Jews were always seemed to be talking about. Nonetheless, the streets were abuzz. No one seemed neutral about Yeshua or about the day's activities.
The crowds were bigger than usual. Thousands always gathered for the festival, but this one seemed different. You could feel it. It just seemed like the whole city was angry. Mobs are angry people. I was with my family. My sons Rufus and Alexander were there. It was the end of a long journey and we were exhausted. We had only just made it in time for Passover. I could see over the crowds the cause of the disruption. The Romans were leading some poor man carrying a wooden beam, keeping the crowd away. I saw him fall. He could barely move under the weight of the heavy load. It was hard to see the man through the blood. They had taken a crown made of thorns and had smashed it on his head. He had been beaten and whipped beyond recognition, yet he was still alive, though not for long by the look of it. I can only imagine the pain he must have been in. "Make way for the King of the Jews," they shouted, more like a taunt to us. Maybe that explained the anger of the mob. As I got closer, I could see instead the anger was directed at the man being led along. I heard the insults, the spit, the curses, but there was nothing from him. He wasn't fighting it. He wasn't trying to escape. He seemed determined on keeping going, but was exhausted and beaten so badly.
It was the third hour of the day. That's 9 a.m. your time, when I instructed my soldiers to carry out Pilate's orders and crucify Yeshua. When I first saw him, I have to admit I was a little caught off guard. I'll never forget his seeming willingness to be crucified. He didn't fight, cry, plead, or beg. My men led him quietly down the road and out of town. It was the crowd that was in an uproar. He looked weak and fatigued. Obviously, the scourging that Pilate had ordered had taken its toll on him. Some of my men decided to have a little fun at his expense. They'd taken a crown of thorns and driven into his head, and streaks of dried blood still covered his face. I had to let it go. We had to maintain our superiority. Before long, Yeshua collapsed under the weight of the cross. So my men enlisted a stranger from the crowd to carry the heavy beam for him. Now don't misunderstand me. It wasn't that we felt sorry for him or anything like that. I simply wanted to get on with my job.
Of course I knew it was going to happen this way. Did you think I hadn't searched the scriptures to find out what would happen to my son? Virgin birth in Bethlehem, called from Egypt, healing the sick, releasing those held captive, raising the dead, giving sight to the blind. The donkey as he rode to Jerusalem, the zeal for his father's house. These were all written in the Tanakh. It is the rest that pierced my heart. No mother wants to watch her son suffer rejection, humiliation and pain. Beaten to the point of being unrecognisable as a man. He is going to carry the iniquity of us all. Finding that written in no way makes it easier, and it has been a constant, somewhat overwhelming shadow knowing that it was going to happen at some point. To be the saviour, he had to suffer and die. It was the only way. He knew it. He'd grown up knowing it, and he was determined, willing, no wanting to do it. Because it was what his father wanted. That was all he was wanting to do, to fulfill that which his father asked of him.
Near us, he falls again. His guard, the soldier, well, he's had enough. It's taking too long, and he grabs me. He literally just pulls me out of the crowd and says for me to carry this man's cross. Well, I'm not going to argue. I've often seen what the Romans did to keep us in line, so I get my shoulder in under his arm and kind of lift him and the heavy beam together. I carried what I could, but he was determined. We began to walk, and he, I don't know how to describe it, he knew what he was doing. The sense I got was he was determined to get to the place of execution, but he was exhausted. He courageously staggered on and on until we got there. Then when the soldiers laid him out on the cross, he seemed relieved, like he had arrived, and they nailed him to it.
When we got to the top of the hill, my men quickly did what they had been trained to do. They drove the steel spikes through the flesh of their wrists and raised the heavy wooden crosses up and dropped them into a hole. The sign Pilate gave us mocked the watching Jews. This is what happens to the King of the Jews. We waited and watched and had a game of dice to see who won his clothes. Yeshua seemed to get most of the attention of the crowd that day. Some of the people were mean and vindictive in what they said and how they acted. In the eyes of others, I could see hurt, disappointment, and even despair. I thought to myself that it looks as though his followers didn't have the courage to attempt any kind of rescue. Removing the leader had always been the best way to stop a movement. I knew that Yeshua was being thrown to the wolves not because of what he had done, but as a political sacrifice to satisfy the Jewish leaders. I was impressed by his bravery. He didn't curse my men or try to resist them when they put him on the cross. In fact, it almost seemed as if he was there willingly. I've seen enough crucifixions in my lifetime to know how much pain he was in. He hung there on that cross, stripped of all his clothing, all of his dignity, exposed to the elements. He was obviously in excruciating pain, yet he seemed so calm, so sure of himself, and at peace with it all. How he maintained his composure was a mystery to me. As he looked at those around the cross who were insulting and ridiculing him, he said something almost unbelievable. Yeshua said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." I thought to myself, who is this man? Where does such love and strength come from? My respect for Yeshua of Nazareth was growing. He was crucified with two criminals. At first, both of them yelled at Yeshua. One of them said, "If you're the Christ, then save yourself and us." Suddenly, the other criminal's attitude changed. He looked at Yeshua and asked Yeshua to remember him. Yeshua looked at him with those same eyes of loving compassion and promised the man that he would be with him in paradise. I've never seen a man die the way Yeshua died. Two people who were obviously distraught made their way toward the cross where Yeshua is hanging. They undoubtedly knew him well. They didn't say a word. They just wept. Yeshua looked at them the way a mother looks at her crying child. He seemed to be telling them goodbye. He said to the grieving woman, "Dear woman, here is your son." Then he looked at the man standing beside her and said, "Here is your mother." The man nodded, took the woman by the hand, and led her away from the hill called Calvary. What kind of man cares for others while his life has been taken from him? The hours passed. It was the sixth hour when something strange and unexplainable happened. It was midday, but it became dark as night, and it stayed like that for hours. The whole thing was beginning to bother me more and more. His innocence, his actions, his words, the crowds, the weird darkness, all of it. As the ninth hour approached, that's 3 PM your time, Yeshua looked toward the sky. I watched his eyes. He seemed to be searching the heavens almost like a lost child searching through a crowd of people for his parents. With a large sigh, he cried, my God, why have you forsaken me?" A little while later, with his chin drooping near his chest and his lips cracked from dehydration, he said, I thirst. Someone gave him a sponge filled with vinegar. The next thing Yeshua said sounded strangely triumphant. It sounded like the blast of a trumpet after a battle had been won. He shouted, "It is finished!" I thought to myself, what's finished? Was he speaking of his life? Was it something more? It sounded like he was saying he had accomplished what he had set out to do. It sounded like a shout of confidence, like he had completed a task. Never have I heard a man proclaim victory as his life was being taken away from him on a cross. The last words he spoke were the words to his father. He said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And he died. And then, to add to all the mystery surrounding him, at the very moment he died, there was a huge earthquake that shook the earth and split rocks apart. It was terrifying. I was standing at the foot of the cross, and I knew I was standing in the presence of holiness. Surely, this man was the Son of God.
I watch it all. I hear him cry out to his God who has forsaken him, just as in the psalm. I see the crowds mock and insult, just as in the psalm. The soldiers gamble for his clothing, just as in the psalm. I see his pierced hands, just as in the psalm. And I understand. Isaiah declares that he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. And I'm watching it as it happens. Oh my God, my heart breaks. My soul cries out for Yeshua as he bears the brunt and carries the weight of judgment meant for us all. Oh my God, help this man carry this load. I experienced the earthquake in the darkness. I heard Yeshua's triumphant shout that it is finished. I remember the rest of Isaiah's words that declares that after he has suffered, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. I recall the ending to the psalm that he has done it. And Yeshua has. He has succeeded. In death he is triumphant. As Isaiah says, he has become our salvation. I can only stand in silence as I contemplate this.
Should have been me up there. I was the one who was supposed to be hanging on that cross. He took my place. Then I looked up. He took a deep, agonizing breath, and then he shouted, "It is finished," and he died. It should have been me up there.
I see it as the cross is lifted up into the air, and I remember his words. I am going to be lifted up, and whoever puts their trust in me will be saved. I suddenly understand. Yeshua saw this moment coming. He knew it from the start, and he loved so deep he did it anyway. I was finally convinced. Yeshua isn't a heretic or a lunatic. He's not even a prophet or a teacher. He is exactly who he claimed to be from the beginning. He is the Savior. In horror, I wonder, what have we done? Everything I spent my whole life building, all the ambition for position, for prestige, for wealth, look what it accomplished. And then I remember something I found so confusing so many months ago. "Nicodemus," said Yeshua, "you will need to be born again." Maybe I can begin again. Maybe that's exactly what Yeshua had been promising. But just as I feel that my own life is truly beginning, I watch as Yeshua breathes his last. I no longer care who knows. I do not care who sees. We boldly ask to be given the body of Yeshua. So Joseph and I carry Yeshua to a nearby garden where Joseph owns a tomb, and we begin the dirty work of preparing the body for burial. We use a mixture of spice called myrrh to bind within the linen cloth we wrapped around Yeshua. The mixture weighs over 30 kilos. It is worth a staggering sum. At our hands, Yeshua received a burial that would be the envy of kings. And then, as the sun begins to set, we place Yeshua's body in the tomb. I look down at my hands that are now covered in Yeshua's blood, and I try to comprehend how this could possibly be the end.
I was surprised to see that no one else was near, and that, apart from a few women, none of his followers were within sight. I started thinking that with the day ending, they needed to hurry to get the bodies down before the Shabbat. There was no way that they would be allowed to handle the bodies during the days of rest, but there was no one moving or making any motions towards getting it down. So I did. I don't know what started it. Maybe I wanted to make amends for the decision to condemn that I had been part of. Maybe I wanted to honour in some way the servant who suffered. Anyway, what I could do, I did do. To get the body down required permission from Pilate, so I had to build up the courage to find him and speak to him. I couldn't bear to have his body desecrated by remaining nailed up there for days, or for him to be buried with the criminals. I didn't care that to touch his corpse would make me unclean. That no longer mattered. Pilate was surprised that Yeshua was already dead. Once he had spoken to the centurion on duty, he allowed us to proceed and we took down the body and wrapped it in linens, myself and Nicodemus. We had no time, so I offered up my own waiting tomb. We took him to the garden and we laid him gently down in my tomb and sealed it shut with a stone. If the prophets were correct, he wouldn't be needing it for long.
Oh, the fragrance of that perfume. It was beyond anything I have experienced. The aroma filled the room as it ran down his hair and into his beard. How do you describe a smell? Like summer flowers in the cool of the morning, like spices in the market as the musicians play gently, like a gently flowing stream over rocks as children laugh and play, like forgiveness. Somehow these fail to describe what that perfume was like, except to compare it to the fragrance of what it means to know him. What she could do, she did do. That was what he said. He said I had anointed his body with the perfume poured from the broken alabaster jar, and he declared that I had done a beautiful thing. That I had prepared his body for burial, were his words. He had been telling us all along that he was going to be rejected, would suffer and die, but no one understood. How could we? To go from the joy of the entry into Jerusalem to the pain of death on a lonely cross in just a few short days is beyond what any of us could have pictured. We couldn't understand that things could change so quickly, and now he is gone. I could only hope with all of my heart that the rest of what he said would come to pass, that after 3 days he would rise from the dead, just like Jonah.